I'm Mike Martin, Wine Director for Vinci Fine Wines in New York City, New York.
Christy Frank, Frankly Wines.
Jason Wagner, Fung Tu Restaurant.
Patrick Watson, Back Label Wine Merchants.
Raj Vaidya, Restaurant Danielle.
Jack Mason, Marcha Restaurant.
Jessica Brown, Wine Director at the Breslin Bar and Dining Room and the John Dory Oyster Bar.
I've told you many times how great 750 is, but don't just take it from me. There are many, many buyers who are using 750 to make their lives easier every day. With access to detailed wholesale pricing, a calendar of upcoming trade tastings, and seamless connections to their sales reps. Check out 750.com for yourself and get signed up. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Andrea Fassoni of Anotria Wine Imports on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello, Levy. Thank you for having me.
So you're originally from Torino?
Yes. I was born in Torino and soon moved just in the outskirts of the city because my father was put in charge of a factory that was opening to manage the staff. And so I grew up just outside of Torino, a few miles away. But then I went back to Torino to go to high school and then university. So my life always revolved around the city.
What was Torino like in the 60s and 70s?
Definitely smaller, definitely all for Fiat, that is the main car company that back then was really strong as a presence in the city. And a lot of people think about Torino as a factory city because of Fiat. In reality, Torino was the capital of Italy when Italy was founded in 1861. As a matter of fact, there is still the palace. There was the Palace of the Parliament. We had the kings, the Savoia kings. So it's also an historical city. It was founded by the Romans. We still have some of the Romans' ruins. And so it was, yes, revolving around the Fiat. But it's always been, I think, a beautiful city.
Were you into wine when you were growing up? Or
not really, if not because my father was a wine lover. He also grew up in Torino, but originally was from Monferrato. And my mom was from the southern part of Lange, and so we used to go often to visit the grandparents to hang out during the weekend, but really often, like every other weekend, either Lange or Monferrato. My grandfather in Monferrato used to make wine, mostly Barbera, a little bit of Rouquet, because he was in Castagnole, Monferrato. And so I was involved in that sense. My father was a wine lover. We always had wine at the table. I started drinking early. And that was a way. So it was not a big interest, but was part of my life. Myself, I preserved that love. I was always visiting also wine sites, like going to Lange, going to Valpolicella, going to Montalcino, or something like that.
So when did you move to the States?
I moved in 2001. I was hired by a wine company. And through a connection I had with a friend whose cousin was working here, we came here with my friend to visit in 1998. I liked very much the city. I didn't think for a second I was going to move here because what was the opportunity to? But actually, in the year 2000, just seeing again this friend, I said, hey, if you want to move here, we are looking for somebody. And I was like, why me? Anyway, I thought, why not? I was in a period while I was working, I don't know if I was happy or unhappy, what was I doing, but the fact was that I would have been happy to come to New York. So what I did, I went through a couple of interviews, both in Italy with the two partners of the company. One was an Italian and was so spending a lot of time in Italy, and the other in America that I met at the Vinitaly 2001, and they told me, whenever you want to move, and after a couple of weeks, I was here.
Why do you think they picked you? I mean, it doesn't sound like you had a lot of wine background.
I don't know. I really don't know. Probably they saw somebody that was committed, honest. Could have maybe somebody that was going to be able to make it. My personality, you know, in selling, you have to be outgoing. Or at least it's better if you're outgoing. So probably that's what they have seen. And I don't know. I guess they liked me.
So you got to New York, and what happened next?
What happened next for 2-3 months, I was waiting to put together my visa situation. So I actually went back to Italy, got the visa, came back here. It's now August 2001, and I started working. I did a couple of weeks of training, and then I believe it was August 13th. I was on my own by myself, bag, wines, go. Business cards and go. And
what was that like for you? I mean, not knowing a lot about wine and then suddenly you're asked to open up accounts.
I'm a curious person. I read a lot. So I made a plan for myself. So I said, let's start visiting some people. The person that trained me told me what he was doing. And so I...
What was that? I mean, how do you open accounts when you don't know anybody?
You do cold calls. So you walk in a place that eventually you have studied earlier. I always call it the detective technique. You read about the place. Back then, internet, yes, was around, but no, was not that big. Not a lot of blogs or not a lot of newspapers online. But I remember I bought a couple of magazines that had reviews about restaurants. So I was walking around. I made the plan for myself, a map. I remember I wrote down a map of the city, just doing avenues and streets. And then I start visiting a bunch of accounts. And while I was around, you know, you look around. Oh, there is a wine store there. Let's walk in. Oh, there is another restaurant there. Let's walk in. You take your note. You go back. And eventually you start sampling. And I remember August 29th, I opened the first two accounts. It was one a store and one was a restaurant. They are both gone.
But it was a regional Italian book, right? I mean, a little French, a little Spanish, but mostly not big, well-known brand names from Italy, right?
Yes, yes, that's right. A lot of small estates. Yes, branding, yeah, there were a couple of brands that were known, but definitely there was a lot of work on our side to go out, present the portfolio, the estates, and having the ability to sample and talk about the wineries and the wines.
You know, I think a lot of times when in an earlier time, people would have thought, huh, regional wines of Italy, not so interesting to me. Like, I'm interested in things that are going to sell more. So I can imagine that being a tough intro.
I think it was a moment right then. I don't have an earlier experience, so I don't know. But where people started to be attracted to those indigenous varietals that they were not popular in New York, but neither in Italy. Because living Torino in the period, I remember wine lists being 80 or more percent wines from Piemonte, then a little bit of Tuscany and a little bit of Valpolicella, not even Veneto. Yeah, maybe some Prosecco, of course, but maybe not even. So Primitivo or Nero d'Avola, Cannonà were not popular, not even in Torino, or not that much. So coming here was a kind of a similar experience, but I would say probably New York was more open-minded to that. There was whatever big city in Italy, because even going around Italy, you can see in Venice, mostly wines from Veneto. And going to Friuli, the wines from Friuli. Going to Firenze, the wines from Tuscany. So everything was very regional. And so coming here and having the ability to present those indigenous grapes, indigenous wines, was actually exciting in the way that we were ambassador of something, some territory, some grapes, somebody making still those original grapes from their tradition. And so, yeah, it was interesting to be able. Yes, the reception was most of the time not interested, difficult to sell, but I could tell then there were a lot of young Italians or American chefs that were going toward Italian cuisine, the authentic one, if I can say so. So the regional one. American chefs that have traveled to Italy to learn and brought back all the experience they accumulated, or Italian chefs coming here. So bringing regional cuisine was also for them a selling point to match with regional wines. So I would say that there was, I could see then a moment of transition and more open mind attitude toward Italian wines.
So was some of that generational? As younger people came up, they were a little more interested in...
I guess so. Generational, cultural, yes. But and also sort of a business plan. You know, I'm going to cook cuisine from Sicily. I want to carry Insolia and Nero d'Avola, for example. But I have seen then people that were doing like, I am from this region, I'm going to have almost all the wines I can carry from that area, like 50 Aglianicos, or 30 Negromaro, 20 Primitivo, stuff like that.
So you started to see people doing that? And a lot of times those wines were a little less expensive. I mean, the book you were working with was, most of it was pretty cheap, right?
Yes. Yes, yes. Besides the usual expensive. Yeah, there were a lot of wines that were I think, really good values. They could have been by the glass, and they were by the glass. That was actually, I think, the way that we and the restaurateur broke the ice. Cannonau by the glass, and Arnaise by the glass, stuff like that. Lagrange by the glass. And so there was a way, hey, you're asking me for the usual Chianti or the Pinot Grigio? Try this. And so I think that was the way to break the ice.
Were there grapes or regions that originally you didn't see as that popular that became more and more popular over the time you were working with them?
Some grapes, they were not popular in Italy either. Like one that I can think is Pecorino. I remember about 10 years ago, around maybe 12 years ago, I heard about this winery from Marche, we are going to make Pecorino. And of course, everybody else jokes about it, like the cheese. And it was this white grape that nobody had really planted anymore, or was just blended in a white blend, if not a red wine. And they started to take care of this grape again, and so on. There was a clear example. Also, I think in the matter that the technology helped the Italian winemakers to vinify some of the tough, hard-to-vinify grapes that they couldn't handle earlier, so to be able to pull out some better wines. Sometimes I also think that if some grapes disappeared, there was a reason. Maybe they were not that good, so there was not a reason to have them back.
But, I mean, it must have been tough times in Italy after two world wars and economic depression and phylloxera kind of all hitting. Must have been tough, or some things probably got lost.
In that matter, I sort of saw that because my parents were both born during the Second World War in the early 30s. So I actually used to love sitting at the table. We often had family reunions and listening to those World War I and World War II stories, because my grandfather on my father's side, he was in World War I. And so I heard a lot of the stories, and I have seen them overcoming those difficulties. And even though my parents were not involved in the farming business, but I could see already then how, what type of struggle it was, and not only, also what a beautiful new life after Second World War, to what they called the boom, the Italian boom, you know, to revamp an economy and to overcome the disgrace that was World War II. And later on, I've seen it, like, talking in depth with winemaker, wine producer, also what they have done. I hear story, I'm pretty familiar with the Lange wine area, that they were in a bad place up to 25, 30 years ago. And they were really farmers, and they were really struggling. Now, we might think Barolo, Barbaresco, these fancy wines, but a lot of those families, number one, back then, they were not only Barolo and Barbaresco, but they were like hazelnut growers, cherry growers, whatever type of fruit they could grow, vegetable growers. They were a farm 100%. And some of them, few of them, they still do that. But what I see more now, and of course, they focus on the wine business. Well, if they are good, they can be successful and make a good amount of money. But hearing the story from the parents or those grandparents that are still around, you can see all over Italy what the type of struggle it was definitely for them to overcome such difficult times.
And you encountered some difficult times in New York, because you got here and then September 11 happens pretty quickly after.
Yes, it's after 4 weeks after I started on my own, as I said earlier. Yeah, September 11 happened. I have a very clear picture of the day. I went to the bank early in the morning, as soon as they opened. It was on, I guess, at 9 a.m. I used to live in Carroll Gardens then. And I was walking back home, and I see this smoke toward Manhattan. And I hear sirens, a lot of sirens, firefighters, ambulance. And I wonder what's going on. So I go home and I'm ready to get dressed, go take the subway and come to the city to start my day with my bag and my wines. And I just turn on the TV just to see what's going on, but not really thinking, oh, let me see what's going on. And what's going on, that they are talking about one airplane hit the one of the Twin Towers, and then right away is the second. And at that point, of course, I see, I realize it, but it's not very clear in my mind. I get dressed anyway, and I walk toward the subway. Subway is closed. Meanwhile, a lot of the smoke is coming toward Brooklyn. And so I said, let me go and see. So I know what's going on, and I walk toward the Brooklyn Promenade. And meanwhile, while I walk there, both towers are collapsed. And ashes, piece of papers, everything is flying toward Brooklyn. So I go to the Brooklyn Promenade. It's all foggy, and there's a pretty realization of a disaster. I walk back home, and then phones are down. Internet, I still had a dial-up internet, so it's down. And the only thing that I have, the TV, I watch a little bit of this news, and it's pretty sad. And anyway, the day after, I decide to go to the city, and the city is like a war zone. Up to 14th Street, I believe, there were tanks, police, army, National Guard. I had a lot of friends afterwards telling me they couldn't access their house for months. It was pretty bad. So the next couple of days, I walk around, I try to see some accounts, but yes, uptown is different. It's like nothing happened, really. And it's just a little bit like what happened for Sandy, you know, downtown, the a disaster, uptown, kind of okay. So, but everybody's talking about my business is going to go down, it's going to be bad, it's going to be terrible. So I start thinking, what am I going to do? I just started here. So I have two options. One, go back home. And two, stay here and work hard and see what I can do. Option one is a no. I don't want to go back home. I was very excited in the first place to come here. I want to make it here. I want to stay here. And I want to try. My boss is very gracious. He calls a meeting right after, probably the week after, and says, hey, we are all here together. Let's work. Let's get out. Let's do our best. I'm going to support you. And let's make it happen. And what happens is that I decide that I to go out and visit as many, do as many cold calls I can. I collected about 500 business cards. And by the end of those 3 months, I open about 20 accounts, probably exactly 20. So I see it's working. And the situation around is getting a little bit better. Business are getting back on their feet. So I can do it. And from then on, there was a turning point because I realized into such a big tragedy and such a difficult moment, you know, the human being can really push and make it and overcome. And I think was a turning point probably. We'll see my life. Because after that, after a couple of years, I was the best selling rep. And then they asked me to travel around the United States to represent the portfolio as a sales manager. And then I went to school, to NYU, and continuing education for a couple of years in the evening to improve my knowledge or to get some knowledge about managing and communication. Became general sales manager. And so I had pretty decent career for somebody that came from Italy, like, what am I going to do here? And
so who are some of the key restaurant relationships that you formed over time? I mean, who are some of the people that you developed relationships with as customers that were longstanding?
One, for sure, Il Buco, with Roberto, that is still a really good friend. Some of the people that worked at the Bastianich group. And even the smaller accounts, like, for example, Bread, that is a place in Nolita that opened exactly when I started in August 2001, became an account of mine after a few months, and the owner is my best man. So there are relationships that's a beautiful part of our business, where, you know, business becomes also personal relationship, and so it's beautiful. I think it's the best, or one of the best part of our business.
And what was it like traveling to different parts of the country? I mean, I probably imagine that you saw different environments for Italian wine. How did those differ to what you'd seen in New York?
Number one, traveling was great because I love traveling. So I had the ability to visit a lot of the cities and the states that, as an Italian, you have seen in movies or read about it. And so it was great traveling. And just to tell you, I went for 4 years every month for a week to San Francisco. That is not a bad place to go. Of course, I was working there, but I love San Francisco. It's a beautiful city. So it was an opportunity to see San Francisco and to travel around. I used to go to Sacramento, Los Angeles, along the coast, Carmel, Monterey. Yes, to sell wine, but also looking around and enjoying nature. Then I visited Texas, Georgia, Florida, Washington, D.C., and surrounding area, Boston and Massachusetts, Chicago. So I've seen a lot of the big American cities. As per the wine scene, it was about 10 years ago. Yeah, there was even more difficult to see those unusual grapes. And so traveling, I even felt more as an ambassador of Italian wines. And that first pushed me to read much more about Italian wines, to learn much more about Italian wines, to ask many questions when I used to go to Italy to visit wineries or to the Vinitaly Fair. And so coming back with information and try to spread those information also, because, for example, in Georgia and in Texas, we used to deal with big companies. And so meetings with a lot of sales reps, like 50 reps. So you really have the feeling that you're going to pass some information. And so you try to do your best to pass as many as you can, to be as truthful as you can. And yes, it was difficult to bring there some of those unusual grapes that we mentioned earlier. But we did a good job. We made it happen. And yes, it was mostly Montepulciano and Chianti and Sangiovese or Pinot Grigio. But something else went through, like the Tokaj back then, the Friulano that I can think, Refosco, or let me think, Primitivo, Negromaro, Aglianico, so some of the unusual.
And did you find that it was a market where you're essentially selling to other Italians, or is it a market where there was more interest from American consumers?
It was definitely more Italian business driven. As per my clients, was definitely directed mostly to Italians. And we were talking a lot about niche wineries and niche wines. As per final consumers, no, it was definitely a lot of Americans. So right there too, also there was the meaning of doing staff trainings. Don't forget that the figure of a sommelier is kind of recent, even in New York, if you allow me to say so. I don't remember a lot of sommelier 10, 12, 15 years ago, mostly in the Italian restaurant side. In the French, yes, like La Côte Basse, La Caravelle, Lutèce, yes, they used to have the sommelier or more than one. Some of American places as well, but like Gramercy Tavern as an example. But in the Italian restaurants, there were not a lot of sommelier. So I have to say, so sommelier have been really useful to spread the voice with their knowledge. But before that, was mostly about sales rep or distributing company holding some staff training and discussing those wines, those grapes, opening bottles, tasting, and going through the geography and the history and so on. So what we did is mostly through Italian accounts, we did those staff training and so on. Then eventually that voice spread it through the final consumer. So to answer to your question, mostly American consumers.
And when you would visit the producers, did you find changes in the regions developing?
If I have to talk as a consumer of Italian wine, so we can go back about 30 plus years, I definitely noticed a huge improvement in quality. I tend to say that 30 years ago, if not 40 years ago, 35 years ago, 80% of the Italian wines were pretty bad, 20% of Italian wines were good or really good. Now is the opposite and way over the opposite. Most of the Italian wines are good wines. Example, well, the cooperatives now in Italy has a lot of cooperatives. Back then we're called cantina sociale, like social cellar, where everybody used to bring the grapes and squeeze and make some juice. And the quality was not good. It was like pretty poor. Now the quality in cooperatives and in some areas very much is really good, great, excellent. But even through small producer, and going back to what we discussed earlier, they were coming from bad periods. So They didn't have opportunity to do better. They didn't know better. Technology has helped a lot. Nice press, soft press, and stainless steel vats, cleaner environment. So that has been helpful. So that in general is what I have seen in the Italian wine business. Quality going much, much higher.
A lot of times I think in the press that those kind of rises in quality were associated with the famous consulting enologists. But when I look at your book and then the book you used to work with before, I don't see a lot of those kinds of wines where they're kind of the star power enologist. Did you see it more as small producers were just gaining more knowledge on their own? Or
the idea when I started my selection in 2008 was family-owned winery, small to medium-sized, indigenous grapes, very honest, committed wine producer that they just express what is their terroir. That was the vision. And the idea of going after two big consultant enologists, I mean, has never been a no or a yes. Just what happened at the vision was different. Just try to reach those type of sources and go and taste and talk and walk the vineyards and go and look at the barrels and taste from the vats and open an older vintage, open the current vintage even though it's not released. All those stuff, because also for me is a must. I visit all the wineries I represent now myself, and I walk through the vineyards, I talk to them, I spend time with them. That is a must. And so that was the main point. And trust me, I've done a lot of kilometers in Italy. I've tended to a lot of tasting a lot of wines for my own knowledge, and also for the reason that when I select something, I want to be sure that it's something that fits my concept that I like first and that I can sell. That is a good price. That is a correct price, I would say. And that is the whole point. So having a consultant enologist doesn't matter. You have it, it's okay. You don't have it, let's see what you have to offer.
Why did you decide to start your own business?
Because in January 2008... I go to my boss and I say, okay, I basically climb the ladder to the top. Now, I have a little amount of money and I would like to buy a percentage, whatever, 0.5, 1%, 2% of your company. And he thought it was a very good idea. Yes, let's talk about it. And March was like, yeah, I have to see with my accountant. There's some issues. And then May, maybe not. And then I lost a little bit of the passion, let's say, the interest in, like, what's going on here. Yeah, I can stay here. I was fine. I was making good money. I liked the people. I liked what I was doing. Probably I just saw the possibility to go further. And so I decided to open my own company. And I resigned in September 2008 and gave with a 2 months notice, and in November I was on my own. End of December I received my first 40-foot container, and then I started by myself with all the connection I had. They were important, of course. You need, if you're selling wine, you need an outlet. And so I started by myself, and then right after I hired my first rep that is still with me, and then I went on, and now we have a team of 7 people selling, including me, because I still have some accounts.
But starting in 08, I feel like that was a period of financial decline for New York in general, the country.
Yeah, not as September 11, there was a big tragedy, but definitely in September 2008, there was a crash in the stock market. And I have to say that luckily, this starting vision helped, because I decided to have wines that were good and well-priced, so good values. And some of the wineries eventually I wanted to have with me, they were not available because they were with other importers. So I started with a dozen of producers, and I went out, and a lot of those wines were in the by-the-glass price range. So I had those placements that I needed to move wine and to pay for the first container and to have another coming in, and so on and on. Then, as I said, another person joined me to sell. And so, definitely in the bad period, what was helpful and was, or lucky, was the choice to have good stuff at good prices.
And it was probably helpful that you weren't sitting on a lot of stock, that you didn't have a warehouse full of wine.
One of the ideas at the beginning was, and actually talking to a colleague importer that just opened like a year before me, I was like, do I open with 3-4 wineries and I carry more stock, like instead of 100 cases, let's say 200 cases, or I want to have a little bit wider portfolio. And said that 12 wineries is still a little amount. But I went for the second option because I thought that my clientele would have had more opportunity to look into my selection with a little bit a diverse selection of wines instead of having just a few wines. So that was the idea. And yes, eventually you face the out of stock. Somebody is in love with some specific wine and say, hey, I don't have it. It's coming in 15 days. It's coming in a month. And you work with the patience of the buyer, and where you have good relationship, they understand and they say, don't worry about it. And where you don't have those relations, they move on and they pick something else. And then it's going to be your turn. Somebody else is going to be out of stock. And then you come in and then say, hey, I have it back. All right. Might be your turn.
But again, you focused on regional wines as opposed to some of the heavy hitters from Barolo, Amarone, Tuscany. I mean, you have wines from Piemonte and Tuscany, but it seems like you really focused once again on a diverse portfolio all up and down Italy.
And when we started also, there was the option, what is available? Because a lot of the wineries were taken. So we explored those options, and out of, I don't remember, 25, maybe 30 wineries I have tasted and then visited, I said, okay, let's start with these. And yes, there was a Brunello producer that was started with me here in New York and is still with me. And I had a couple of wineries from Piemonte, and not Barolo, not Barbaresco. And yes, I didn't have those big names. I didn't have a Chianti. I don't think I had a Prosecco since day one. No, I did not. I tasted it, but they were not ready and so on, so I did not have it. So we went for Morellino di Scansano as an alternative of Sangiovese. We had Roero instead of Barbaresco. We had something that was, for me, I was just fine. I was trained to go out and sample those stuff. So there was, I met the people. So I really, really was like, I picked you. I want to represent you. I'm going to make it happen. That doesn't mean that all those wineries are still with me, because something didn't work eventually and we moved on. And I would say also my vision didn't really change, but improved, maybe. I noticed that lately when I select a wine, if the wine gives me a sense of place, it really hits me, it really strikes me. And it happened a couple of times recently. One with a Slovenian winery. I tasted at Dusseldorf, a Provine. And I was like, this juice is really the grape. This juice is really the soil. I want to go to see. And I went. After 6 months, I went. I went to visit him. And I started to carry the wines. Second, a winery from Sicily. Yeah, you want to come to taste some Nero d'Avola? I said, meh, no thank you. Not interested, not attracted. Maybe it was a little bit of prejudgment there for sure. I said, no, please come. They also make Moscato di Noto. Ah, let's go. So I went and I tasted through the lineup and I was like, wow, I want to visit them. Again, that sense of place. I want to see. There was the soil, there was the sea, there was the salt, there were the flowers, there was the honey. There were some stuff that I said. So in that sense, from the starting point now, I'm much more focused on that. When something is really the grape, the soil, the weather, the people. So that is now what I'm going for.
What had drawn you to that was the fact that they made a Moscato di Noto and that was somewhat rare.
For me, yes. It was like more than the Nero d'Avola that, as we know, has become pretty much common, was Moscato di Noto. Instead, it's a small area. Also, they make it dry and they make it sweet. So when they said that, I say, yeah, let me see. And a little lesson what was taught there also. Don't prejudge only because somebody says, hey, we make a Chianti or a Montepulciano. Then you may think, oh, no. It's a little bit snobbish, right? And just go. And that has always been my attitude. But sometimes, you know, you have your downsides. It's like, oh no, another winery to taste. Oh no, another wine to taste. I see that from the buyer's side. We say, hey, you want to taste this Nero d'Avola? No, no, thank you. Please taste it. I really wanted you to taste it. And you start talking about your own experience. So eventually the person gets some interest in, and then you get into taste. But then, yes, the Moscato di Noto, thank God, brought me to that booth.
But I imagine if you're representing all those different regions of Italy, that's a lot of driving and travel for you. I mean, it's not like you just fly into Bordeaux, visit the producers in the area. And
there is a little bit of everything. There is, yes, going to wine fairs. Like, I've never been to Bordeaux. That actually is happening these days. Provine I've been. Been Italy several times. Merano Wine Festival. Lately at the Grandi Langhe. So I go to those events also to see what's going on in the wine world. And there you have the option to taste hundreds of wines. So you see other producers represented by other people, what they do. You see people that don't have any representation and check them out. Eventually, you're not interested. You already have the type of wine. You don't want to cannibalize one of your wineries. But then, yes, I love traveling. So for me, it's a pleasure to go. But it's also a must. It's an obligation I have to go to check what they do, where they are, and so on. And also, the bottom line goes to trust and to truth. Because sometimes, you know, we might say some stories that are not real. No, I wanna check. I wanna put my finger into it. I wanna know, and also I wanna get in touch with you, wine grower, in a different way. Because when you go to their house, their environment, and you know what it means, the table or the dining room, and they cut their own piece of cheese or piece of prosciutto or salami that they made, or the wife or the mother prepares a meal for you, is all a different setting that sometimes didn't help me. And I tell you why. Sometimes I've picked wineries because I like the people. And I thought the wines were better than they were. So that's where I learned a lesson that was like, why did I buy these wines? I have them here now. I'm not really happy with this wine. Because I was not business-minded. I was like more feeling minded. I put my sentiment into the moment and I was like, oh, I like these people. They are really nice people. Their wines are good. And I didn't focus on taste. And now something that I have developed definitely is something like take a few seconds, focus on the wine that you're tasting. Focus on everything you're doing. The glass, because sometimes they give you like a water glass to taste their wines. They're like, you're crazy. The temperature, where you are, what you're eating with. All these little details that then bottom line, you're going to start to import hundreds of thousands of bottles, and then you have them here, and you're not happy. And yes, you feel bad for those families because you like them. But unfortunately, it's not something that you really feel and you really don't want to go out. And for me, the problem is also passing this to my sales force and to my clients or potential clients, because if I don't like it, chances are that they will see my body language and say, this guy is talking about something that he doesn't really believe. So that is a lesson that I have learned. So yes, I want to meet you people. I want to talk with you, but let me detach for a second or a few seconds and make my decision or take some honest notes and then read them and say, is that really what I'm looking for?
And I imagine that sometimes pricing is difficult. You know, if you're trying to have a lot of values in the book, some lower price things going for wine by the glass, I imagine sometimes you encounter producers who want to charge more than would make that possible.
And that's the fight. That's when the fight starts. One of the first visits I've done in the 2008, they asked for a price. And right away, I thought, never going to sell that wine, that weird grape for that price. So right away, I reply, this must be the price. Otherwise, we cannot do business. And the wife and the husband left for a little bit. They came back and said, okay, let's start like that and let's see how it goes. And you know, when they have seen the first year selling 4,000 bottles of that wine in their grave, they were happy. So thank God they accepted and they understood and was good for me and it was good for them. Some other times, you talk and you deal. It's a cooperation. It's a chain. You make the wine and I understand how much you spend to make the wine. But if I bring it over for a price that is not the real value of the wine, I'm never going to sell it. And I can acknowledge that, you know, you're doing low harvest, you are using the best oak, you are hand-picking, so paying some workers to hand-pick and some stuff. So I'm going to put that into account. But then we go to a bottom line where your wine has to be sold. And if I cannot sell it, then I'm going to be eventually a lover and a collector of your wines. And for instance, I have a winery from Val d'Aosta I really liked. But I thought, I'll never be able to sell this wine. And I bought 6 bottles and put them in my cellar. So the guy was like, oh, wow, you only 6 bottles. I'm sorry, but you told me that we cannot under those prices. And I understand it. And I'm not going to argue about it. And so if we cannot go below, I'm going to be your fan, but I'm not going to represent you because I cannot sell your wines.
And I imagine, you know, you mentioned now that it's important to taste the grape and the soil of the place. But I imagine that in the past, there have been periods of time where that was less important in the market, where people were looking for different things. Have you seen a change in what consumers or sommeliers tend to be looking for from Italy?
That still happens. That still happens. Some wines are pretty anonymous, mostly when you go with that fashion of international grapes and blends in some areas of Italy, in a lot of areas of Italy. So some producers decide that they want to go that way. But I think with the evolution of taste, and I'm not talking only about wine, but cuisine as well, that definitely we have seen in New York, but I would say all over the world, thank you to this great chef and master chef and so on, is leading and it led to more fine palates. So I think, you know, people are attracted by this different, let's call it like that, type of wines. And like, for example, Italian wines tend to be dry, earthy. And it's something that for some people is kind of disturbing. They want a fruity, they want a smooth, kind of fruity, sugary. And yes, in some cases it's difficult to pass those wines along, but some other people and more are attracted by those unique gems.
Do you think that there are, amongst producers in Italy, that there's more interest in indigenous grape varieties, or does it just seem like that here?
There is definitely interest, also because for them could be a selling point. Like, I produce what is the fruit of my land. And that's actually what I see amongst some younger winemakers where they picked up the business from the father of their grandfather. How are we going to be a business? Yeah, okay, we're going to make wine, but then we have to sell it in order to make money. So one of their selling points is I use the grapes that are indigenous of this land. So some of them tend to stick to that. As well as is a selling point to do blends, international brands. You know, we're going to appeal this type of clientele and some people go other direction. Or I've noticed, as an Italian, I know that we follow fashions. And in the wine business too. I would say in the last 20 years, there was the period of barrique. Everybody barrique. In Italian, we say vino barricato. And saying vino barricato was the meaning of quality for some people. So, Barbera Barricato, Dolcetto Barricato. Of course, I'm talking about Piemonte. So I'm sure that in France, they made a lot of money off it in those years. Then there was a period of blending. Merlot, Syrah, Cabernet, Petit Syrah, Petit Verdot, and so on. Then I would say that now is a trend of residual sugar, making wines that have that finish that is, you know, a little bit sweet, easy, smooth. I don't like that. Anyway, instead of all the people, they're staying truthful. They say, these are the grapes. That's what we're going to do. And we do our best. So,
and what have been the big surprises in terms of regions or grapes that you weren't familiar with before recently?
My love is extreme winemaking. So mountain vineyards, Valle d'Aosta, Valtellina, Alto Adige, Etna, or something I've seen in Sardinia, on the beach, on sand. I've seen also in Ciro, stuff like that. I like to see how wine making in Italy has been so ingrained in the culture at whatever level we discussed earlier. You know, they were not making great wines then, but was a source of food, was a source of calories. So they were still making, not that good, but in order to drink them. So it's been so ingrained that you see some sites that is like, what are they doing here with the winery? I remember I was in Val d'Aosta, Tourette Superior. Two rows of vines at about 1,000 meters above the sea level, and then two rows, just these two rows, and then a big drop down. It's like, why? It was a family that had these two rows of vines, was able to make an amount of barrels that were excellent for them to sustain them. And so that is great. When you go to Valtellina, you see that left side of the valley with all those terraces. And still, these days, a lot of the producers that we see, that they put their labels on their names on the bottles, they outsource from a lot of growers that have half an hectare, a quarter of an hectare. And then, you know, they work like little corporate with a contract. Say, you're going to grow the grapes. I'll come and check quality. And then we'll pick and we'll make a wine under my label. So that is what has been very attractive to me, to see how this wine culture is ingrained in the farming culture. And it's very fascinating.
In terms of wines that were ageable wines, what did you find for wines in terms of length of bottle aging that may have surprised you? What has gotten better and better in the bottle, whereas you might not have thought it would?
I think mostly the white wines. The surprise was that. Because years ago in Italy, we never thought about aging white wines in bottles. Yes, we knew about the Barolo. For example, I remember in my father had some 1960s, some 1970s Barolo in the cellar. We are talking about end of the 90s, beginning of 2000, just before I moved. So, yes, I knew about Barolo. I knew about Châteauneuf du Pape. I knew about some other grapes, other red wines that you could age. But the surprise, talking about Italian wines, came from the white wines. And how you could see in some areas where they were able to make white wines long-lasting, like 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. I think we have to go back to technology. In some cases, they were not able to preserve the wine, so the results were off white wines after a while. And of course about terroir, because when we go to Friuli or Alto Adige or somewhere like Soave, we go to Marche for the Verdicchio. I mentioned a few, you can really see some white wines that can great potential in the bottle.
And what about the challenges back home? Is it difficult in the market to sell these kind of wines? What's the competition like, and where do you see yourself fitting in?
It is just because of the fact that there are a lot of wines here, starting from wines from all over the world. So for the final consumer, maybe a Malbec is not a big difference from a Montepulciano when it's $7.99 or $8.99 on the shelves. And then if we go specifically into the Italian wine business, yes, the competition is fierce. And I am one of the cause. Because the competition is fierce, because opening in 2008, I opened one of those small companies, just like a lot of my colleagues, former sales reps, opened in the business. And, you know, it's just part of the nature of this business. We are in New York. I think everybody is competing. Restaurants are competing. Wine stores are competing. And we are competing as well. And the beauty of it, because if I can bring here a Collio winery, maybe I can bring two or three or four. So as a sommelier, as a wine buyer, or as a retailer, you want to have a wider selection, so you will outsource from different importers and distributors. So yes, as a downside, but also the nice part is that we can bring in really a representative selection of Italian wines.
So now you're in a position of hiring sales reps. When you hire sales reps, what do you look for in them? I mean, it sounds like when you started, they weren't necessarily looking for wine knowledge in you, and yet it worked out quite well. What do you look for in sales reps who apply to work for you?
Yeah, probably the same thing that my bosses found in me, personality, meaning that you have to be outgoing, number one. You have to be a hard worker. You have to be able to overcome issues. So once, about 10 years ago in San Francisco, I hired a gymnast. And my boss told me, why are you hiring this lady? Because she was able for years, day in and day out, to practice and make it happen. We're going to teach her something about wine. We're going to teach her something how to approach accounts and so on. And worked out well. So here you have an hard worker, committed person that loves what she does. I'm talking about gymnastics. Yeah? Let's see if she can translate that into the wine business. So that's what you need. My first rep was and still is an actor, mostly theater actor. Yes, of course, there you see the personality in the person. But he's graduated in economy, so he understands business, he understands organization, he understands managing, and worked out really well. I mean, he has very good numbers and so on. So I think also that's what you see in New York. You see people that eventually they are not fit immediately for a job, but as a tailor, you start to nip and cut a little bit and you can do that. On the other side, I've seen sometimes people with very good knowledge of wine being poor sales rep because their communication skills, they're going to the accounts, calling, doing cold calls. It's very cold in New York. It's very hot in New York. It's raining. It's this, the competition and so on. Is not your job.
As you grow your own company, what's next for you?
Next for me is expanding. And I am actually working, expanding in what direction? Expanding the portfolio. Eventually, we have 3-4 interesting things coming in the fall. These days, actually, and in the fall. Eventually, hire some more people to work in your state and going out of state. So basically, going back to what I did when I was in a former company. So being importer for some distributors. We already have started that in a couple of areas. We are actively working to expand that, doing some partnership eventually. So the idea is, again, to be the ambassador, I've said earlier, in a wider area. So approaching more states. And for what I hear, because I don't travel as much as a business person, but I see or I talk to people, I think the country is readier than was 10 years ago to accept those grapes. And also what I said about chefs, you know, some chefs, they were in New York and they'd go to Nashville to open a restaurant. They go to Cleveland to open a restaurant. Or they were in San Francisco and then they go to, I don't know, some other states like Utah or Colorado. And they have good food. They have excellent food. They have authentic regional food. They wanted the wines to go with. So I think it's the right time. This is why I'm pushing toward that direction these days.
And do you see yourself carrying wines not from Italy, or is it always going to be an Italy focus?
I would say that Italy is and has been my expertise since I traveled, I drank, I tasted, I met, I read about Italian wines. Even though I spent some time getting a sommelier degree with the American Sommelier Association, so in those classes you approach much more French wines, American wines. But it's definitely more my area of expertise. And we have a Slovenian winery, but we kind of consider it a little bit Italian, where 1/3 of their vineyards are in Italy. But it could go in that direction, but I'm not that sure. I think I like the idea of representing my country, and I want to do my best. So I will keep focused, I'll keep studying, I keep reading, I keep tasting. And I probably stick with Italian wines.
Do you see a different market for Italian wines in retail than in restaurants? And if so, how?
Yes. And, okay, I said yes right away, but sometimes, most of the times. And I think it's because of the support that the client gets in a store versus the restaurant. As we discussed earlier, we have a lot of sommelier or people that have knowledge on the floor now that can help you to go through a list that maybe has hundreds of wines. So if you are open-minded and you will ask, I've never heard about this region or of this wine, can you tell me? Somebody's there for you. In stores, I see in New York, in the New York metro area, that happening too, where you have very knowledgeable people working in stores. Probably though, it's a work in progress and more in restaurants than in stores. So the point is that as a consumer, I walk into a store and I'm not familiar with some of these unique grapes. chances are I will pick something I'm comfortable with. Probably this still what happens in restaurant when people don't want to ask somebody, can you help me with this wine list? They will probably still go for the usual ones. Instead, if they ask, they get help. So that's where I see the difference.
Andrea Fassoni, he's been seeing the difference for Italian wine for a number of years. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Levi.
Andrea Fassoni of Anotria Wine Imports. Hey, I've got an idea for you. How about saving some money when you purchase the wines that you already like? To help you do that, we here at the podcast have teamed up with the excellent folks at Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan to offer you wines we talk about on the show at a discount. All you have to do is check crushwineco.com, that's crushwineco.com, for the latest offer and use the discount code IDTT for me. That's IDTTFORME to get your special price as a listener of this show. You'll be drinking well with wines you are knowledgeable about, you'll be saving money, and you'll be helping out the show. Check out crushwineco.com and make your own voice heard. That was our show. Thanks for listening. I really want to say thanks also to the so many, many people who have left a comment in iTunes and a rating in iTunes. Thank you. I originally started asking people to do it in this segment here, and we went from about 70-something to 180-something. It's an incredible amount of change. It's a huge help to the show and getting the word out about it, and I can't thank you enough. I mean, regular listeners, famous winemakers, people I count as friends, but also just a ton of people that we've never maybe even met, but I appreciate words so much, and it means a lot. Thank you. For those of you who haven't left a comment or a rating in iTunes, if you do get a time, please, please do so. It really does help out the show in terms of our standing with iTunes and getting the word out to other people who may just never have heard of the show and may be interested in hearing about wine at a level that they're not used to finding. Otherwise, if you'd like to reach us, you can find us on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod or on Facebook. We have a Facebook fan page there. Or even on Instagram. I'm on there at LeviOpensWine, L-E-V-I. You can also go to our website. It's alldrinktothatpod.com. You can find back episodes there. You could order up a t-shirt or a coffee mug with our logo on it. Or you could send us a donation if you'd like to. The instructions are on the website. We're always trying to keep the conversation interesting, and we appreciate that you take the time to listen. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next show. Love you.